ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
ABC Cricket Podcast time with your boys, Corbin Middlemass and Ed Cowan, for your Monday, back in our OG time slot. It's nice to see you, Teddy. The world's upside down, and yet here we are talking cricket, just for a bit of normality and a bit of consistency in people's lives. Lovely to see you on this Monday.
Likewise, Corb. Likewise. Not much has gone on since the last time we talked on Friday, but we'll dissect everything that has.
Might just start there. I mean, I've got some listener questions we'll get to. We'll talk about the cricket on field and everything else, but basically how the global conflict is going to impact cricket and sport in general. I've read the report in the SMH that both Ben Stokes and Freddie Flintoff are among a number of England players and foreign nationals looking to get out of the Gulf. They were in Abu Dhabi serving as coaches with the England Lions team. Scheduled game against Pakistan A was subsequently postponed, as you can imagine, so I'm sure that would be very unsettling for those individuals and so many that are in and around the subcontinent at the moment, Teddy, trying to get home, given the flight delays and what's going on in the world more broadly.
Yeah, I'm no geopolitical expert, but of course, you know, people forget the ICC headquarters is in Dubai, and that's certainly in some kind of focal point, so like all these things, Corb, you know, your heart breaks in many capacities. Just for people like us that are pacifists and on the other side of the world, it's hard to kind of fathom. So let's hope that it all resolves pretty quickly.
There's Australians caught up over there at the moment, working on, you know, in the media, for example, and various other roles, commentary, Aaron Finch and Matt Hayden and Mark Howard, obviously, all over there at the moment. So safe travels to everyone that's trying to get home, and more importantly, to the people that are in the region at the moment and the terrifying nature of what's going on. I saw Alex Hartley's Instagram post, a series of them this morning. So she arrived at the airport, Teddy, in Sri Lanka, trying to get home to England at 4:30 in the morning. And you could basically follow it slide by slide as the journey that she was on and the sense of relief that she felt when she finally got a flight home at midnight. So this has been there since 4:30 in the morning. And the flight, I think she was saying, went through like Singapore and then another stop and then on to England. But she was like, look, I don't really care. Like that's as long as I'm out of there.
Takes.
I'll sit in the middle seat down the back. It's sort of to be able to move on. So, yeah, thoughts with all our friends that are impacted by what's going on and the uncertain times I'm sure all of you are feeling at the moment. A couple from our listeners, Teddy. So this is from Samuel Teddy Doggett, who sent me a message saying, one for your love of Brian Bennett. He's only been dismissed once in this tournament, so he's averaging 277. I don't know if you saw his... Did you see his press conference?
I can't say I saw it.
So he rolled up to his press conference afterwards and started to get this lengthy question about Bennett and his innings and what he should be doing. And essentially he sort of looked confused around the reporter and then turned to him and said, I'm Bennett. So I think the reporter wasn't quite sure who he was chatting to originally as to who had fronted up to do press. And the other unusual thing that happened in the World Cup since we last spoke was the sped up New Zealand national anthem. Did you hear that?
No.
I'm going to have to send you some inbox on the social media clips doing the rounds.
When I'm off the socials, I miss all the good stuff.
But basically, the New Zealand national anthem played at times two, so the whole thing's just flying through to its conclusion. Which naturally, I mean, I work in the audio game, so I have to listen to a lot of audio all the time. That's how I listen to a lot of content, is sort of sped up, and then it's easier to kind of edit and move through of what you want. So for me, I didn't actually hear all that much different, but for people that aren't used to listening to the almost like the chipmunk audio, as it's, you know, very high pitched and moving through.
Let's get to the cricket, they'd be thinking. You know, why don't we put all anthems on 2.5 times speed and just get to the cricket a bit quicker?
One more off from one of our listeners. This is from James, who I'll read the end first. He said, P.S. I love Ed's book, In the Firing Line, and can't wait for the sequel.
Sorry, I've got some bad news on that.
Hi, Corbin. I've been based in Darwin over recent years and was pumped to see when Cricket Australia confirmed its schedule. I think the territory is a severely underrated place and applaud CA for committing to represent the massive geography of the country. But I would be curious to hear yours and Ed's thoughts on the commercial and development factors at play here. Darwin's 140,000 residents places it at a humble 17th on the list of Australian cities by population. It would be unrealistic to expect Darwin to turn a huge profit, so I'm left curious as to what the reasons the administrators have in scheduling these games. Apart from the climate, Teddy, what's the motivation to be up there in the north of the country?
Well, the climate plays a factor because you can obviously play cricket in the northern half of Australia when you can't play in the southern half and the football codes are on. So it gives you a footprint in winter. When James talks of profit, you also got to think of, okay, from what's the main revenue line on a test series like this? It's TV rights. And what's the main cost outside players? And it's ground hire and putting on the event. And that is obviously substantially lower than renting the SCG or the MCG, which Cricket Australia would do. But obviously you get bigger crowds. So I don't know the exact bottom line number, but I wouldn't be surprised actually if it's more than what James expects, okay, given that the TV audience is going to be the main driver there. There's obviously, as he mentioned, a great development angle, but if it means there's more test cricket that the broadcasters can pump through their airwaves, the better in many respects.
I hope that answers your query a little bit, James. He goes on to point that obviously the AFL and the NRL play games up there and there's commercial deals obviously with the government. But as you said, if the costs are relatively low and you can put the event on and sort of clear it in that particular space, then yeah, there is a scope to try and make a little bit of a profit along the way.
Yeah, I mean, you got to think that the Futures Tour program, you have to play these nations at some point. So what is the best place to play countries that aren't going to draw a crowd at the SCG or the MCG or the Adelaide Oval, and it actually is regional in Australia and let the game grow and also minimise the cost impact of doing it.
Where do you want to start on the cricketing front, Teddy? Do you want to start with the women's game or do you want to start with the World Cup? What do you want to do?
Definitely want to talk about the women's ODI yesterday specifically.
Does let's start there. Alisa Healy, okay. I mean, 158 off 98 balls. There's so much to this. I don't know if you saw her dismissal. So she ended up getting bowled by this rank full toss and she sort of walked off almost embarrassed. And you're like, Alisa, just lap it up a little bit. Like, you've just made 158 off 98 balls. But the progression from, first 50 was 49 balls, second 50, 30 balls, third 50, 16 balls, went from 100 to 150 in that time. And, what's left to say about Alisa Healy?
What a way to sign off your ODI career. Like, I actually can't think of, and you're the stats guy, I just throw things out there. I can't think of any player, male or female, that's had a better finale. In their last ever game, they not just peel off a match-winning 100, but do it in the style, do it at the pace. It was breathtaking.
Yeah. And generally, by the time you get to the end, a lot of players, they're sort of
over the line,
running on empty, not a lot of tread left on the tyres. And yet you sort of watch a play, you think, where are you going? Why couldn't you can play as long as you possibly want.
I like sports people going out on a high. Retire a year earlier than you think, rather than bleeding it dry.
I'm the other way.
But why?
Because, to get every single little bit out of yourself that you can. That at the end of the, so you can turn around and you can say, look, I wanted to play right to the end, and I left because I couldn't do it anymore. That was it. And I think we're not going to remember him any differently. Like, if Alisa Healy, had a terrible run of form and played in the next 2 years or whatever.
I totally disagree.
Legacy secured. It's not as if,
I disagree. If I think about the last couple of years of Dave Warner's career or even Usman's career, that's kind of where my mind gravitates to. It's they played too long.
But you think that now, in 10 years' time, if I say to you, what was David Warner like? You'd be like, oh, he was this amazing player. He was a daring opening batsman and everything else. Like, I think maybe in the short term, yes. But when I think of, I'm trying to think of some other examples, Ricky Ponting. I don't think of Ricky Ponting face down on the turf after getting rock and rolled by the Proteas or whatever. I still think of, that glorious swivel pull shot and, one of the best batsmen I've ever seen in my lifetime. I don't know.
I think of both. When I think of Ponting, I was lucky enough to play with him, in those years, and I still think of, he was my hero, but I still think, oh, geez, could have, would you have preferred to go out at the, not necessarily the peak of your powers, but you know, the diminishing aspect of, but it happens. So we're allowed to disagree on
we
this.
We are. If it means he's sitting there as like a 45-year-old, 50-year-old man, and he doesn't feel like, oh, maybe I could have kept playing. Like, I think that's worth it, that it's like, hey, you squeezed, wrung the towel dry, you got every single little bit out of it, and everyone got a chance to, you know, to share in it.
So I'll give the playing point of view, because there's no doubt for the last 2 years, I'm sure Hilzo has felt the grind of training and travel and, you know, like, so just because she's playing well and did in this innings, and I think largely because the freedom that knowing that you're finishing can have, you know, there's no another series or something to prepare for. You just go and enjoy the game, and you can experience that in club cricket if you retire from professional cricket, just to enjoy the game and play with the freedom that it deserves. But the last couple of years, irrespective of whether you're playing well or not, is going to be a grind. And so, you know, you may as well have that lasting memory of enjoyment rather than, you know, not resentment, but yes, I got everything out of myself. You got everything out of yourself your whole career. But that last little moment, if you know you're not playing well, that's torture.
But there'd be part of them.
Why not have this happy memory of the game and how you finish?
There'd be part of them though, always feeling like I can get back there. I can do it. I've done it before.
Maybe.
Like, and yeah, maybe that's easier to see on the outside than it is for the individual. But it doesn't bother me one bit. She got an umpire's call on 24 on an LBW, and then that was really the closest she looked to getting out before she was dismissed. So 158. 120 of her runs came from boundaries. So you talk about playing with freedom. 27 fours and 2 sixes. Only 12 runs short of her previous high score for someone that, you know, debuted 16 years ago, as you said. What a way to go out. She finishes with almost 4,000 runs at 37. But the strike rate of 100 is really what's going to define the era, isn't it? When you think about, you know, women's cricket before Elisa Healy came along, and yes, there wasn't short-form cricket in the same way that there was in Healy's career, but to be able to move it on and score it, a run a ball, and yeah, just have that sort of eye popping style that it, you know, when she was genuinely one of those players that, you know, if you're walking past the TV and the innings was about to start and she was opening, you'd sit down and go, oh, look, I had something else to do, but I'll just watch this until Healy gets out. Like, she, you knew something was going to happen.
Without doubt. An entertainer in every sense, played the game in the right way, always moved the game forward. It was never playing for a draw. In the longer formats, always looking to hit boundaries in the shorter formats. So it was a style of play that resonates with many people watching the game. And, you know, people that play the game dream of playing the game like that, but it's bloody hard to do with a smile on your face.
Yeah. They made a heap. They made 409. Mooney also got 100. And then India all out for 224. 4 wickets for Alana King, a 185-run win for the Aussies. They now lead the multi-format series 8-4. Which basically means, yeah, I think you can only get 4 points for a win. So unfortunately for India, the best they can do is now level this series, and a draw would be enough for obviously the Australians to win the series. India have won the toss in all 6 games. One of these other sort of bizarre trends. We've seen a few of them in recent times where, you know, one team just gets hot at the coin toss, and that's certainly India.
Is that a thing? Can you get hot at the coin toss?
Didn't we have one here? Or it was the other way. Yeah, I think India got really cold, didn't they? They had a period in the men's game where
it's pure luck.
Bizarre. There's some statisticians out there that talk about it's a 1 in a billion chance or whatever it turns out to be, and there'll always be people clap back and say it's a 1 in a 50-50 chance, and you think to be on the wrong side of a 50-50 decision that many times is where you get that algorithm and everything else. Positive signs from the series. So Lucy Hamilton made her debut. Georgia Vol, the 22-year-old in the second game, struck 100.
What a start.
I think we're going to be all right there, aren't we?
We're going to be just fine. Yes. Our women's team's going to be just fine, folks. Take a breath.
And just what we should have mentioned when we're talking about Healy, did you see her bowl send a couple of overs down?
I missed that.
Yeah.
That's a farewell.
I was about to say, you'd be done by then with the result secure, but
I love my cricket, but not that much.
Yeah, not watching Elisa Healy bowl in the second innings. There was a great line in commentary, though. Mitchell Stark was there working for Channel 7, and basically, you know, Healy, who's dominated as a batsman and a wicketkeeper her whole career, and Mitchell Stark, her partner, has, you know, taken, what, over 400 test wickets or whatever it is. All of a sudden, he's sitting there in the commentary box, and Healy comes on and bowls. Bowling with the cap on, bowls a little off spinner, the rank short ball, gets pulled away for 4. There's just silence. There's a few applause, and then the next voice you hear is Mitchell Starc saying, "It's not that easy, is it?"
I thought he might say, "Pitch it up, would you?"
To bowl in international cricket. And yeah, there we go. The other news out of just lastly on the women's game, Australia, their tour of the West Indies is going ahead, but with no test match. So this was meant to be a multi-format series. They will instead play the three ODIs and the three T20s later this month, which concludes on April the 2nd. West Indies expressed their desire to prioritise white ball cricket ahead of the Women's T20 World Cup in England this June. The West Indies haven't played a test since 2004. They haven't played Australia in 50 years. So it feels like a pretty soft reason, to be honest. I mean, you could still play the six white ball games. I don't know. What happened to the test match?
Well, I'll take the other side here. I actually think, realistically, women's test cricket is going to be confined to maybe three countries, maybe four. Why not prioritise what you want to prioritise at home, knowing that they haven't played a test in 22 years?
Yeah.
Why now? Like, for what purpose? It's we know for sure the women's test cricket is not going to take off in that part of the world.
Mm.
Ever. So for what purpose are you trying to reinvigorate it? For the tip of the cap to history?
Yeah.
Once every 50 years? So the next test match that Australia play the West Indies is, what, 2076?
Yeah. So my argument would be, why come out and say you're going to do it to begin with? Because it sounded like a good thing to do when you were touring Australia and you thought...
Maybe, exactly. Know. But who cares? That's an opportunity cost.
And then to say,
keep moving.
It was meant to be 3-3-1, and now it's just 3-3, and they're saying they're prioritising the white ball game. It's like, what, by not playing it? It's just... Anyway, it's not as if they're now playing eight white ball games.
I'd like to see two T20 games in there as well. You know,
yeah. Anyway, that's what it is.
Two T20 games. 5-3, and we'll call it square.
As the old school announcer would say, speaking of T20 cricket, the T20 World Cup is up and moving at the moment. And we now have our final four teams. We had our virtual quarterfinal last night. And Sanju Samson, who'd been in ordinary form, must be said, leading in his previous eight matches. I think he had a best score of 24. He had four scores, 10 or less in that time. And then he comes out last night and basically plays a match-winning knock. He finished 97 not out. 26 ball 50, and he guided guided India home against the West Indies. Basically, it was an interesting moment where at one stage they still needed like 10 and over with 5 overs to go, and then he got the equation down to 7 off the last over and effectively did it in 2 balls. So I think the next best score was in the low 20s. It was really a single-handed performance that got India there.
Yeah, it was. You look at the scores and you think, oh, two things, come to mind. One is, geez, they had their work cut out, India, to qualify, chasing, 199. But then the flip side of that coin is, what a fine tune-up, and they proved their favourite credentials to really time the chase perfectly. 50 off the last 5 overs, wickets in hand on a good wicket like it was last night. You're expecting them to do it, and the only thing that can happen is pressure at the wrong times, losing wickets at the wrong times, people make mistakes under pressure. But with a batter in like Samson, you should cruise, and cruise they did, and they showed that to be able to pick off that chase as methodically as they did, and win 5 down, you kind of think, oh, that's kind of Rolls Royce stuff,
Sharma hasn't really got going at all tournament, no. So that's scary heading towards a semi-final and then a final that you think, geez, the best T20 batsman in the world, surely he comes off at some stage in the tournament. Then Kishan was out for 10 last night, so I think there's a lot of people that will still be quite happy to be on India at this stage, needing to win 2 from here to win it. The West Indies, by the way, they did really well to get to 195. They were 1-68 in the 9th over, so they were crawling. Shea Hope never got going, made 30-odd off as many balls. And Roston Chasu decided to open. Like, it was that, why would you try a new opener in the quarterfinal stage of the tournament? And then it was Rothman Powell and Jason Holder, who were, I was about to say, two former captains, but most of the team's former captains. Everyone's had a go at leading the team.
Everyone's had
stage.
A crack at it, haven't they? Yeah.
They basically got them up there to a pretty reasonable score of 195. So what that means, Teddy, is we will have on Thursday, essentially, early hours when you go to bed Wednesday night, but Thursday morning, 12:30 a.m. Eastern, New Zealand up against South Africa. So that's at Kolkata at Eden Gardens. And then when you go to bed Thursday night, so Friday morning, 12:30 a.m. Eastern Daylight, England and India.
That's a blockbuster.
Mumbai. That's a proper game, isn't it?
That is a blow. Will you stay up? You know, that's the kind of game you do tend to stay up for. That's going to be a cracker.
England beat New Zealand in their last game. So
Only just.
Three balls to spare. Saw Matt Roller's analysis on this on ESPN Cricket Info. So pointed out that England bowled 16 overs of spin with five different spinners. First time that they've ever done that. And you'd be thinking, oh, yeah, conditions and everything else. But when you dig a little deeper, so in the Harry Brook captaincy era, when he took the reins, basically, which is a year ago, there were 11 overs of spin was the most that England had ever bowled in one particular innings. They've passed that seven times now under his reign. So is that the game changing, or is that what he's got at his disposal? Is that England's thinking? So seven different times they've bowled more than 11 overs of spin in the last 12 months.
Yeah, spin to win. I would need to know exactly where they've played those games, but we've seen throughout this tournament that sometimes the faster you bowl, the further it goes. Archer probably being the exception. He's really the only out-and-out quick playing in that team. Sam Curran bowled an over, but, you know, between his, you know, the moon balls and the slower balls, and, you know, he's bowling fast, unpredictable spin at times. And they've done well, but they needed to work hard with the bat, you know, at that back end of the innings. I can't remember the exact equation. Maybe it was 40 off 3 or something, but they had to work hard, 6 down. Ahmed, you know, smacked a couple at the end and got them home.
Also saw Matt's analysis talking about the matchup between Glenn Phillips and Will Jacks, which I loved this as
similar cricketers, aren't they?
As an observation. So with Will Jacks bowling to Glenn Phillips, so Phillips made 39 off 28, but against Jacks, he scored only 7 runs from 9 balls and was cleaned up by an off break. Now flip it. So when Jacks faced Phillips bowling, he only faced 4 balls, took him for 14, went 6-4-4. So in a game that ultimately is decided, as you say, by an absolute breath at the end, being able to get on top of him with the ball, Will Jacks, against Glenn Phillips, and then take to him with the bat. It's basically the match came down to that one matchup, and England won it and ultimately won the game.
Yeah. He's had some tournament, Will Jacks, hasn't he?
Yeah.
I mean, took a fine bat catch and ball, and he's an excellent fielder. So that's, I don't know if he was officially man of the match, but he could well have been. So that would have been 2 of his last 4 games.
Mm.
He's some player in this format.
Shikata Raza, who's the captain of Zimbabwe, he was man of the match last night in a losing cause. He made 73 off 44 and took 3 for 29. And his team was pumped. South Africa won by 5 wickets against Zimbabwe. So that wasn't close. South Africa running down the target with more than 2 overs to spare. So South Africa undefeated throughout the tournament. So they go through and play New Zealand in Kolkata on Thursday. Who do you like there, Teddy?
It's hard not to fancy the South Africans, but it is a World Cup. So, you know, if you go on World Cup history, New Zealand strong, South Africa not so much.
Mm.
It could be a bit of a roll of the die.
South Africa for me. And England, India?
I'm calling upset.
Oh, I like it.
I'm calling upset.
This has been, I mean, I was big on England at the start of the tournament, but this is exactly what Brendan McCullum needed, didn't it? It's like, it's amazing how...
If they didn't make the semis...
It would have been it.
Gonskis.
Yeah. And it's sort of... And now all of a sudden the Ashes is further in the rearview mirror. You think now everyone's feeling good about themselves. Harry Brook scoring runs. We're not talking about what happened over in New Zealand. They needed this tournament to start like oxygen. It did. Now essentially they can move forward. I think it's already been a success getting to the Final Four. But they're a live chance the way they're playing. Can't wait for that one. That's a proper game. Early hours of Friday morning, so as most of you go to bed on Thursday night. A couple of other little footnotes from the tournament. So Senathjo Surya, coach of Sri Lanka, it didn't end well for them. They lost to Zim, remember, in their last pool game, and then didn't win at all in the Super 8s. They had this weird game against Pakistan where Pakistan needed to win in a certain time to knock New Zealand out, and they weren't able to do it. So in the end, Pakistan won the game close. So Sri Lanka lost the game. They didn't make the semi-finals. They're going home. The team that beat them, Pakistan, are also going home. And Sri Lanka lost hosting rights for a game in a semi-final, which if Pakistan or Sri Lanka had made it, they would have got one of those games there. And you thought, What was all that for then? And then all of a sudden their senior coach, Shanath Jayasurya, comes out and essentially steps down as the coach without really telling anyone in advance. He fronted up to a press conference and said, look, my contract runs till June. I haven't given Sri Lankan cricket any news officially yet. They don't know what I'm going to say to even this. I will need to go and discuss with them. If they can get somebody to coach the team, then definitely they should do that. Essentially saying, hey, look, I'm out. Go and find someone else. And at the end of June, I'm not re-signing another deal.
Oh, I like the proactivity here. You know, more coaches should do that. Well, just you get sacked, I reckon.
Just in the press conference, I'll say, I haven't spoken to them, but I'm not doing it. I'm here till June, and when that's done, I'm done. And just one last one on a Pakistan front. So Shahib Zada Farhan, little hat tip to him. He actually broke the record for the most runs in a T20 tournament or T20 World Cup. So went past Virat Kohli with 383 runs. Kohli's effort back in the 2014 World Cup. So what do we make of all that, that they've had the leading run scorer in the tournament ever, and yet they didn't still get out of the Super 8s?
Yeah, and at one stage, they had the leading wicket taker as well. I mean, it suggests that the team ain't pulling their weight, I would have thought. Runs and wickets can be skewed to when people are bowling at certain times and who face the most balls, etc. But it's a pretty good indicator. The only thing that comes to mind is these are the types of players that we should be able to watch around the world. I know we spoke about it in the last episode, but when you've got great talent, and in this case, the leading run scorer at a World Cup, and there's a world where he only plays in the PSL and maybe the Big Bash, that's sad.
Babar Azam dropped. He's played his last T20 now, hasn't he?
Yeah. Done.
Just on the PSL, I don't know if you caught up with this news. You're a very busy man, but they signed the most lucrative broadcast deal in the competition's history. Now, you could say, well, every broadcast deal you do is essentially the most lucrative, or has been up until now. Maybe it's not going
Australia's
forward.
Last broadcast deal.
You would think it always goes forward, but to Wiley Technologies for the next 4 years to the tune of $93 million. So there's 44 games instead of 34, so it's gone up 10 games, two new franchises, but even if you keep that in mind, the value per game is increased by 21%. So it's an interesting figure, $93 million for a four-year deal, 41 games a season, value per game up 21%. Now, naturally, I went to the CA broadcast deal, $1.5 billion, seven-year deal with Seven and Fox, or Fox and Seven. That's everything. That's bundled together. So it's very hard to work out, what the worth is of the BBL. I tried to do some Googling, even use some AI to try and get a worth for that. And there's sort of random figures chucked out as, 40 mil or whatever it turns out to be. Where does that sit as the PSL now getting a $93 million US deal? What does that mean for our competition here?
Yeah, you're right. So Cricket Australia bundle it all in. So there's no segregation, and it's hard to disaggregate them. Look, there are two lines of thinking around sports rights. One is, they move up and to the right forever. It's appointment television. They'll only keep going as new bidders come into the market, be it Amazon or Netflix, and their appetite for live sport. It's not always the case, and so the opposite argument in many respects is that it's a bloody tough industry, and there won't be as many bidders in the future, and you need multiple bidders to make sure that you maximise the value of the rights. So what does that specific deal mean for cricket in Australia? I wouldn't read too much into it. There's no doubt, I think, if you segregated the Big Bash rights, I don't think you'd get more money than what you get aggregating them in. So,
right.
It's tricky. It really is tricky. And the difference being these PSL or the IPL, they are separate tournaments run by separate organisations with private owners, so they have to separate them. So if there was private ownership in Australian cricket, you would have to separate them to a degree or apportion them to a degree, because that's your revenue line right there.
Yeah.
So I don't know. Let me do some digging on the PSL TV rights. Because you don't know how, because there are different types of, there's kind of your linear television, you got your pay television, and then of course you got your digital rights as well. And this is where the IPL have really extended their advantage, is on the digital rights are owned by the same group as the the free to air, and so that they've been able to monetize in a whole range of different ways. But you need big companies bidding at that point.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I would have thought almost like the old model where you had one network do the BBL and the other networks do the internationals, where you sort of think, surely then you can drive the price up if you've got more players in the market. But you don't generally think that as a basic principle, that you're almost better off saying, hey, here's everything.
I think in some markets, yes. I'm uncertain and I just don't know enough in Australia specifically. But yeah, if you look at the US, for instance, for sure, and you being the NFL fan, you know that they've sold Monday Night Football specifically. Yeah. They've sold Sunday games to different networks, and so they've been forget actually picking off different tournaments. They've got nights of the week that are actually dedicated, and they've been able to ensure the bidding war between those very large companies has ensured massive TV rights.
And I think that's, I mean, maybe this is, again, you don't have to be twirling your moustache to think about incentives and everything else, and that's not why I'm saying it, but as someone that also does some work for Fox Sports, I mean, you think about the TV deal we have at the moment, and I think because we've come out of this era where I think people look back on free-to-air TV with sort of rose-coloured glasses, where I think they think, oh, we used to get every single game live all the time and all that, and you think, you never used to get that. There used to be games that you would just never see across the weekend, for example, that would just happen and wouldn't be telecast in the same way. Whereas now we have, and Fox Sports, their model is very much, hey, give us all of it and we'll put it all on. And so you know that, hey, if I pay my $30 a month or whatever it turns out to be, I can get everything. And there may be a stage in the future where people will look back on this time and think, you know, well, that was pretty good. I could pay 30 months and I could have it all in one place. Where you think, once we start siphoning it off, which you'd think, well, if it ends up like that going forward, then you might not just need one subscription. You might need multiple subscriptions to watch the Thursday game here and watch the Friday game there and whatever it turns out to be. So, yeah, it is, I don't know. It is an interesting model where it would frustrate the consumer, I think, but I wonder whether it would, whether that would actually bring more money for the sporting body, for example, if you, you had to watch different games and different platforms.
Yeah, for sure. And ultimately, you got to provide the best experience for the person.
Well, that's part of it. Yeah, that's part of it, isn't it? Because the other option is people go, you know what, I'm not doing it and I don't love it that much and
I'm out of here.
I'm going to go do something else. The IPL season begins on March 28, so it's less than a month away. The final's been booked for the 31st of May. What are you smiling at?
I'm thinking, can we go on holidays by then?
Well, you'd probably be thinking, oh, when are all these games going to take place? Fixture's not out. So the fixture has not yet been released. And you'd be thinking, oh, hang on, Corbin, there's a major event going on in the world. Well, yeah, there is in the last sort of 48 hours or whatever. But the release of the 84-match fixture has been held up due to pending dates for state assembly elections. And this is the trade-off when you have a country of a billion people, for example, that the host cities, the states that are featured in this, host cities like, Kolkata, Chennai, Guwahati, and the BCCI needs to ensure that security and logistics don't clash with the polling days. Because as you can imagine, trying to get everyone to the polls on the same day that you're also trying to get people in and out of a cricket stadium. But as a result, we're 26 days away and we don't know who's playing who and where the games are and everything else. So
perfect.
Also probably means, Teddy, they're not too worried about people travelling to watch games or international sort of visitors, are they? There's more than enough money to be made just by keeping everyone on skates and chucking it in at the last minute.
That is the last thing on their mind, Corb.
All right, I think that'll just about do us today. Short and sharp, we'll be back again on Fridays. We will. We'll have our finalists for the T20 World Cup. The test match will be underway. And do you know what else we're even going to do this week, Teddy? We're going to play some domestic cricket.
No way. Crazy.
New Shield round starts on Thursday.
Underway by Friday. Look forward to that.
Tasmania Vic at Belrave, Queensland up against WA at AB Field, and South Australia up against New South Wales at Carrin-Rolton Oval. It is, as we love to say in the sports broadcasting game, the penultimate round. So the penultimate round of the Shield season. We'll see how that goes starting on Thursday. Have a great week, Teddy. I will chat to you at week's end.
Later, Corb.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.